Session number 15474, Reel 6.
Mr. Jones, Reel 6.
To do a record to see if we could move on, and he wanted to take me with him with a 18 set on my back so that he could report back. We walked up a road for about a mile and came to a cluster of houses with white flags, you know, white sheets hanging out of the window. And this officer, his name was Gervers, and he said, if we're within, if they're in there and we're in their sight, we might as well approach frontally as try to skirt round, because we're in under observation from those houses. It was getting dusk. And so we decided that we would continue to walk up the middle of the road. We passed the first of the houses on the left, and we heard a commotion and a woman's voice shouting us to obviously to attract our attention. Very aged old lady, by an even older man, followed her out, and they wanted to say that the Germans had gone the day before, but to be careful because they'd laid mines in the road, which when we looked at them, they were fairly obvious, but at least we were able to signal back what we'd found. Then they took us round to the back of the house, and we found a rocket sight, and that's something which was very pleasing to us, because nobody could find out where the rockets which had been firing at us while we were on the spit had come from. So we'd made a bit of a discovery. So we moved on then, looking for this village. Its name escapes me at the moment. But same thing happened there. This was a rather largest village, which I described when I wrote about it as a bit like a village like Saxmundham in Suffolk, where it was just houses on the side of the road. It had no depth. And all these houses on the side of the road had got white sheets outside, flying outside. And yet you had this feeling that the place was inhabited. But we made the same decision. We said, well, we're in view, so let's keep on walking and see what we find. We walked halfway through this village, and you know how you have this sense that something is happening, that you're being watched, there are eyes on you. And as we looked around, people were coming out of houses, and all these Italian people. The place, it seems, had been evacuated the day before by the Germans. Of course, they realised we were English. So we were first English in this village, and the fuss they made of us was like the fuss they made of us when we landed on Corfu. It was overwhelmed with congratulations and kisses and the fuss. In the middle of all this was an amazing voice, a lady's voice, in the broadest Brummie accent you ever come across, saying, "Where you lot been?" You know, it was so incongruous. Apparently this woman had married an Italian just before the war, and of course she knew that entry was imminent. But to hear this voice in the middle of all this jabbering Italian was quite astonishing. They took us to a restaurant where they said that there were a certain German prisoners, and yes, they were. There was about 20 or so German prisoners, but these were something unusual about them. They were Turkoman people. You know that they captured and converted to fight for Germans, and I wouldn't have thought there was very much fight in them at all. You know, they were glad to see us, delighted to see us. There were also some Italians that they'd got there, who they said were collaborators. By that time, we'd been joined then by a number of partisans who had said they had been working down through the German lines. And we witnessed there a horrible incident, really, of where they would not, because of our presence, would not touch the German prisoners. But their own people, they felt we were powerless to stop, and they really lashed into these people. They didn't kill them, they just hit them and beat them about with their weapons and things like that. It was disgraceful, really. But we couldn't do anything about it. We signalled back, of course, about the discovery we've made, and they said, well, don't burden yourself with any of the prisoners. Just come back and we move off tomorrow. The main force will be in there tomorrow to take the prisoners over. And so that's what we did. It was dark by the time we got back to San Giuseppe, is the name of the place. From there on, we joined the general rush of pursuing and trying to get guns across canals and streams and ultimately Bailey bridges across the Po. And our chase finished about 10 miles from Venice when we were sent back to Ravenna, where we were when Churchill announced at the end of hostilities.
In July, I think it was, 1945, there was this general election in which Labour got such a big majority, and there's a lot of speculation about the troops having voted overwhelmingly for Labour and the political attitude of the troops then. What do you remember about that yourself?
Vivid. It's the only time in my life when I'd ever call myself a socialist, and I was as active as anybody else in wanting to oust the government. I couldn't tell you why, except that we'd all heard such terrible tales. We'd read so much in bits of newspapers we got and in the army newspapers about the formidable war minister, Sir James Grigg. He was quoted in some papers of the man who would do nothing for the troops. How true it was, I don't know. But whenever anything was raised in Parliament about the troops, he would say, I am not aware of it. And he became known as Sir James, I am not aware of it, Grigg. So although I knew nothing at all about politics, I knew he was a Conservative, and I wanted to spit in the eye of Sir James Grigg and use my proxy vote with great enthusiasm to make sure that the Conservatives didn't get in. It's the only time in my life I've ever voted other than Conservative. And when the dawning of what I'd done hit me, I felt so ashamed, because here I'd inadvertently voted out of office the Churchill that I admired so much.
But you did some political campaigning yourself?
No, I wouldn't say campaigning. We had a proxy vote, and I was amenable to the general attitude of, I would say that the troops voted overwhelmingly for the Socialist Party, and I was as amenable as any of them.
Do you think the troops are much different from the population back home in their voting?
I had no idea about that, but letters you got from home were naturally enough always saying, well, why can't our lads get some leave from home? Well, now we know it was an impracticable proposition. I had friends with me who were 5 years before they got home. No home leave at all. I was barely 3 years without home leave. But you could understand the population saying, well, you know, that once an overland route had been made through France, why can't we get some of these lads home? And it, in retrospect, it was impracticable. But I, that's why I, the only reason why I think the public wanted to see a change of government, and that, like in, with the same naivety as myself, if they'd stopped to think that by so voting they were voting out Churchill, they wouldn't have done it. They wouldn't have done it. It seemed an ungrateful thing. It was while I was at Salerno that I came across Harry Seacombe. He was, he'd been in the fighting unit, and had done his share of fighting, but already showing show business talent. And they put on a show at Christmas called As Time Flies, which was a bit of a pantomime. And Harry Seacombe was doing his usual thing of a singing duet, playing both parts of Nelson Eddy and Jeanette MacDonald. And he was rather rotund even then, and cut an incongruous figure as Fairy Queen. In fact, I have a cartoon and a program of the whole event. It was too at Salerno, where conditions in that winter were terrible, really wintry conditions, that he claims himself that he perfected his famous shaving sketch, which got him the job at the windmill and sent him on the road to fame. But a few years ago, there was on television a program put on by, I think it was the Water Rats, where they honoured him for 40 years in show business. Well, as he was, to my mind, in show business 3 years earlier than that, because I'd seen him at Salerno, I thought I'd send this little program to him and say, we know it's 43, not 40. And I accorded him all the rights of address, Dear Sir Harry, yours respectfully, and I signed myself Wally Jones. And I said, I'd like you to sign this for me, you know, as a souvenir, if you wouldn't mind. Sent it to him at his club address. I got it from Who's Who. This thing came back, and he signed it. Dear Wally, you know, hope you're okay or something. Signed, Harry Seacombe, Lance Bombardier! Which I thought was lovely.